Eustace Mullins, Murder by Injection. Chapter 3, The Prophets of Cancer. In 400 BC, Hippocrates assigned the name of cancer or crab to a disease encountered during his time, because of its crab-like spread through the body. Its Greek name was carcinos. In 164 AD, the physician Galen in Rome used the name of tumor to describe this disease, from the Greek tumbos meaning a sepulchral mound, and the Latin tumor, to swell. The disease could not have been very prevalent. It is not mentioned in the Bible, nor is it included in the ancient medical book of China, the Yellow Emperor's classic of internal medicine. Unknown in most traditional societies, it spread with the rise of the Industrial Revolution. In the 1830s, cancer was responsible for 2% of the deaths around Paris. Cancer caused 4% of deaths in the United States in 1900. With the rise of cancer came modern methods of coping with it. A leading critic of the medical establishment, Dr. Robert S. Mendelsohn, comments that modern cancer surgery someday will be regarded with the same kind of horror that we now regard the use of leeches in George Washington's time. The surgery of which he spoke is the widely accepted and imposed method of cancer treatment now in vogue throughout the United States. It is called the cut, slash and burn technique. This method of cancer treatment actually represents the high water mark of the German allopathic school of medicine in the United States. It relies almost exclusively on surgery, bleeding and heavy use of drugs, with the exotic addition of radium treatment. The temple of the modern method of cancer treatment in the United States is the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute in New York. Its high priests are the surgeons and researchers at this center. Originally known as Memorial Hospital, this cancer establishment was presided over during its early years by two physicians who were stereotypes of the Hollywood caricatures of the Mad Doctor. If Hollywood planned to make a movie about this hospital, they would be stymied by the fact that only the late Bela Lugosi would be appropriate to play not one, but each of these two doctors. The first of these Mad Doctors was Dr. J. Marion Sims. Son of a South Carolina sheriff and tavern owner, Sims, 1813-1883, was a 19th-century, women's doctor. For years he dabbled in experimental surgery, by performing experiments on slave women in the South. According to his biographer, these operations were little short of murderous. When plantation owners refused to allow him to conduct further experiments on their slaves, he was forced to purchase a 17-year-old slave girl for $500. Within a few months he had performed some 30 operations on this unfortunate, a girl named Annika. Because there was no anesthesia at the time, he had to ask friends to hold Annika down while he performed his surgery. After one or two such experiences, they usually refused to have anything further to do with him. He continued to experiment on Annika for 4 years, and in 1853, he decided to move to New York. Whether his little Negro hospital in South Carolina was surrounded by screaming villagers one night as they brandished torches, as in an old Frankenstein movie, is not known. However, his decision to move seems to have come rather suddenly. Dr. Sims bought a house on Madison Avenue, where he found a supporter in the heiress of the Phelps Empire, Mrs. Melissa Phelps Dodge. This family has continued to be prominent supporters of the present cancer center. With her financial assistance, Sims founded Women's Hospital, a 30-bed, all-charity hospital which opened on May 1, 1855. Like a later quack, Doc Simmons, Sims advertised himself as a women's specialist, particularly in vesicovaginal fistula, an abnormal passage between the bladder and the vagina. It is now known that this condition has always been iatrogenic, that is, caused by the ministrations of doctors. In the 1870s, Sims began to specialize in the treatment of cancer. Rumors began to circulate in New York of barbarous operations being performed at Women's Hospital. The Mad Doctor was at it again. The trustees of the institution reported that the lives of all the patients were being threatened by mysterious experiments. Dr. Sims was fired from Women's Hospital. However, because of his powerful financial supporters, he was soon reinstated. He was then contacted by members of the Astor family, whose fortune was founded on old John Jacob Astor's ties with the East India Company, the British Secret Intelligence Service, and the international opium trade. One of the Astors had recently died of cancer, and the family wished to establish a cancer hospital in New York. They first approached the trustees of Women's Hospital with an offer of a donation of $150,000 if they would turn it into a cancer hospital. Smarting from his recent firing, Sims double-crossed the trustees by private negotiations with the Astors. He persuaded them to back him in a new hospital, which he called the New York Cancer Hospital. It opened in 1884. Dr. Sims later went to Paris, where he attended the Empress Eugenie. He was later awarded the Order of Leopold from the King of the Belgians. Apparently he had lost none of his chutzpah. He returned to New York, where he died shortly before the opening of his new hospital. In the 1890s, after receiving gifts from other benefactors, the hospital was renamed Memorial Hospital. In the mid-20th century, the names of Sloan and Kettering were added. Despite these names, this cancer center has for many years been a major appendage of the Rockefeller medical monopoly. During the 1930s, a block of land on the fashionable Upper East Side was donated by the Rockefellers to build its new building. Rockefeller henchmen have dominated the board ever since the building was opened. In 1913, a group of doctors and laymen met in May at the Harvard Club in New York City to establish a national cancer organization. Not unnaturally, it was named the American Society for the Control of Cancer. Note that it was not called a Society for the Cure of Cancer, or the Prevention of Cancer, nor have these ever been primary goals of this organization. 1913, of course, was a very significant year in American history. During that fateful year, President Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act, which was set up to provide funding for the forthcoming World War, a national progressive income tax, taken directly from Marx's Communist Manifesto of 1848, was imposed upon the American people, and legislatures had their constitutional duty of appointing senators removed, they being henceforth elected by popular senators. They all now had to compete for the popular vote. It was in this heady era of socialist planning that the Cancer Society originated. Naturally enough, it was funded by John D. Rockefeller, Jr. His attorneys, Debevoise and Plimpton, remained dominant in the administration of the new society throughout the 1920s. Its funding came from the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Foundation, and from J. P. Morgan. From its inception, the American Cancer Society has followed the pattern set up by the American Cancer Society. ACS also had a board of trustees, a House of Delegates, and in the 1950s, it also established a Committee on Quackery. This committee later changed its name to the Committee on Unproven Methods of Cancer Management. Note that it was called management, not cure, but the society still used the term quackery freely in referring to any methods not sanctioned by its trustees, or deviating from the cut, slash and burn method of cancer treatment. In 1909, the railroad magnate, E. H. Harriman, whose fortune, like that of the Rockefellers, had been funded entirely with Rothschild money funneled to him by Jacob Siff of Kuhn, Loeb Company, died of cancer. His family then formed the Harriman Research Institute. In 1917, the scion of the family, W. Averill Harriman, abruptly decided to go into politics, or rather, to manage our political parties from behind the scenes. The institute was suddenly shut down. Its financial backing was then transferred to Memorial Hospital. The principal backer of the hospital at that time was James Douglas, 1837-1918. He was chairman of the Phelps Dodge Corporation, whose heiress in 1853, Melissa Phelps Dodge, had been the initial backer of what eventually became Memorial Hospital. She had married a dry goods merchant named William Dodge, who used the Phelps fortune to become a giant in copper production. The Dictionary of National Biography describes James Douglas as the Dean of Mining and Metallurgical Properties. He owned the richest copper mine in the world, the Copper Queen Lode. Born in Canada, he was the son of Dr. James Douglas, a surgeon who became head of the Quebec Lunatic Asylum. His son joined the Phelps Dodge Company in 1910, later becoming its chairman. Because he had discovered extensive pitch blende deposits on his western mining properties, he became fascinated with radium. In collaboration with the Bureau of Mines, a government agency which he, for all practical purposes, controlled, he founded the National Radium Institute. His personal physician was a Dr. James Ewing, 1866-1943. Douglas offered to give Memorial Hospital $100,000, but there were several conditions. One was that the hospital must hire Dr. Ewing as its chief pathologist. The second was that the hospital must commit itself to treating nothing but cancer, and that it would routinely use radium in its cancer treatments. The hospital accepted these conditions. With Douglas' money behind him, Ewing soon became head of the entire hospital. Douglas was so convinced of the benefits of radium therapy that he used it frequently on his daughter, who was then dying of cancer, on his wife, and on himself, exposing his family to radium therapy for the most trivial ailments. Because of Douglas' prominence, the New York Times gave a great deal of publicity to the new radium treatment for cancer. The journalist headlined his story with a page one headline, "Radium Cure Free for All." The claim was made that, not 1 cent's worth of radium will be for sale. Douglas was greatly annoyed by this statement, and on October 24, 1913, he had the Times run a correction. He was quoted as follows, "All this story about humanity and philanthropy is foolish. I want it understood that I shall do what I like with the radium that belongs to me." This was a rare glimpse of the true nature of the philanthropist. His rivals in this field, Rockefeller and Carnegie, always give away their money with no strings attached. With this assurance, they were able to stealthily establish their secret power over the nation. Douglas had revealed the true nature of our philanthropists. The original press releases from Memorial Hospital had in fact intimated that the radium treatments would be free. They apparently believed that the great philanthropist James Douglas would donate his supply. The Memorial Hospital rules and regulations were immediately changed to stipulate that an extra charge would be made for radium emanations used in the treatment of patients. In 1924, the radium department at Memorial Hospital gave $18,000 radium treatments to patients, for which it charged $70,000, its largest single source of income for that year. Meanwhile, James Douglas, who had boasted that he would do what he liked with his radium, continued to give himself frequent treatments. A few weeks after the New York Times story in 1913, he died of aplastic anemia. Medical authorities now believe that he was but one of a number of personalities associated with the early development of radium who died from its effects, the most famous being Marie Curie, wife of its discoverer, and her daughter, Irene Joliot Curie. By 1922, more than 100 radiologists had died from X-rays-induced cancer. Douglas' protege, Dr. Ewing, remained at Memorial Hospital several more years. He developed a number of ailments, the most annoying being tic cholera, which made it embarrassing for him to meet or talk with anyone. He withdrew from the hospital, becoming a recluse on Long Island, where he finally died of cancer of the bladder in 1943. Douglas' son and heir, Louis Douglas, inherited one of the largest American fortunes of that time. He married Peggy Zinser, daughter of a partner of J.P. Morgan Company. Peggy's two sisters also married well, one married John J. McCloy, who became the chief lawyer for the Rockefeller interests. The other married Konrad Adenauer, who became Chancellor of post-war Germany. Louis Douglas became chairman of Mutual Life of New York, a Morgan-controlled company. Early in World War II, he became a protégé of W. Averell Harriman in the Lend-Lease administration. Douglas was then named chairman of the War Shipping Board, one of the famous dollar-a-year men of the Roosevelt administration. Later in the war, he succeeded Harriman as U.S. ambassador to England. After Hitler's fall, Douglas was slated to become High Commissioner of Germany, but he stepped aside to allow his brother-in-law, John J. McCloy, to take this post. The two Americans were pleasantly surprised when their brother-in-law, Konrad Adenauer, was named Chancellor. The family interests of the J. P. Morgan firm were firmly in control. In fact, Adenauer's earlier political activities in wartime Germany had centered around a small group of J.P. Morgan cohorts in Germany. They were ready to take over when Hitler died. In the 1930s, two giants of the automotive industry were persuaded to become contributors to Memorial Hospital. Alfred P. Sloan had been president of General Motors for a number of years. He was also a director of J.P. Morgan Company in 1938. He owned 750,000 shares of General Motors. He owned a 235-foot yacht which was valued at $1.25 million in 1940. Charles Kettering was an authentic inventive genius, responsible for much of today's auto ignition, lights, starters and other electrical systems. Fortune estimated in 1960 that Sloan was worth $400 million, while Kettering was worth $100 to $200 million. Alfred Sloan's credentials as a philanthropist were somewhat marred by his record at General Motors. He had steadfastly opposed the installation of safety glass in Chevrolet cars. During the 1920s, the lack of safety glass meant that a relatively minor auto accident, if it caused the breaking of the windshield or the windows of a car, could result in hideous disfigurement or death for the occupants. Shards of flying glass would drip through the interior, slicing the passengers as it tore by. For a relatively minor amount, the ordinary glass used in automobiles during that period could be replaced with safety glass. Today, safety glass is required on all cars. Sloan made a public statement on this issue on August 13, 1929. The advent of safety glass will result in both ourselves and our company absorbing a very considerable portion of the extra cost out of our profits. I feel that General Motors should not adopt safety glass for its cars and raise its prices even a part of what that extra cost should be. On August 15, 1932, Sloan again reiterated his opposition to the installation of safety glass in General Motors automobiles. "It is not my responsibility to sell safety glass," he complained. "I would very much rather spend the same amount of money on improving our car in other ways because I think, from the standpoint of selfish business, it would be a very much better investment." The Alfred P. Sloan Foundation is doing well. In 1975 it had $252 million, which grew to $370 million by 1985. It and the Charles F. Kettering Foundation $75 million, continue to be the chief benefactors of the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. A liberal editor, Norman Cousins, heads the Kettering Foundation. The Alfred P. Sloan Foundation is headed by R. Manning Brown. Junior directors include Henry H. Fowler, former Secretary of the Treasury, now a partner of Goldman Sachs Company New York Investment Bankers. Also director is Lloyd C. Elam, president of the nation's only black medical school, Maury College in Nashville, Tennessee. Elam is also a director of the giant Merck medical firm, Kraft, South Central Bell Telephone, and the Nashville Bank. Franklin A. Long represents the necessary Rockefeller connection as a director of Exxon. He is also a director of United Technologies, Presidential Science Advisory Commission, Professor of Chemistry at Cornell since 1936, a Guggenheim Fellow. He has received the Albert Einstein Peace Prize. He is a member of the American Pugwash Steering Committee, set up by the notoriously pro-communist financier Cyrus Eaton, who was a Rockefeller protege. Pugwash is said to be directed by the KGB. Herbert E. Longenecker, president of Tulane University. He serves on the selection committee for Fulbright students, a very powerful position. His list of awards and honors in Who's Who goes on for several paragraphs. Kathleen Marortz, who is a director of National Cash Register, also a Guggenheim Fellow. She is married to Herbert Marortz, a chemist from Prague. Thomas Aquinas Murphy, president of General Motors for many years, also director of PepsiCo and the National Detroit Corporation. Elmore E. Patterson, who had been with J. P. Morgan Company since 1935. He also serves as treasurer of Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and is director of Bethlehem Steel, in Gelhard Hanovia, and Morgan Stanley, Lawrence S. Rockefeller, who is director of Reader's Digest, National Geographic Society, and the Caneal Bay Plantation. Charles J. Scanlan, director of the GM Acceptance Corporation, Arab American Bank of New York, and trustee of Roosevelt Hospital, New York, and Harold T. Shapiro, president of the University of Michigan, director of Dow Chemical Corporation, and Ford Motor Company Burroughs, Kellogg, and the Bank of Canada. Shapiro has been on the advisory panel of the Central Intelligence Agency since 1984. He also is an advisor to the U.S. Treasury Department, the governing board of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute, called the Board of Managers, reads like a financial statement of the various Rockefeller holdings. Its principal director for many years was the late Louis Lichtenstein Strauss, partner of Kuhn, Loeb Company, the Rothschild bankers in the United States. Strauss listed himself in Who's Who as financial advisor to the Messrs. Rockefeller. He was also a director of Studebaker, Polaroid, NBC, Rucar, and held government posts as Secretary of Commerce and as head of the Atomic Energy Commission. For many years he funneled Rockefeller funds into the notorious Communist Front, the Institute of Pacific Relations. Strauss was also president of the Institute for Advanced Study, a Rockefeller think tank at Princeton, and financial director of the American Jewish Committee, for which he raised the funds to publish the propaganda organ, Commentary Magazine. Another prominent director of Sloan Kettering was Dorothy Peabody Davison, a leading New York socialite for some 50 years. She had married F. Truby Davison, son of Henry Pomeroy Davison, a Rockefeller relative who had been the right-hand man for J. P. Morgan. Davison was one of the group of five leading bankers who met with Senator Nelson Aldrich. His daughter married John D. Rockefeller, Jr. at Jekyll Island in a secret conference to draft the Federal Reserve Act in November of 1910. The Dictionary of National Biography notes that Davison soon won recognition from J. P. Morgan, frequently consulting with him, particularly during the monetary crisis of 1907. In association with Senator Aldrich, Paul M. Warburg, Frank A. Vanderlip and A. Piat Andrew, he took part in drawing up the Jekyll Island report that led to the crystallization of sentiment resulting in the creation of the Federal Reserve System. As head of the Red Cross War Council during the First World War, Davison raised $370 million, of which a considerable number of millions were diverted to Russia to salvage the floundering Bolshevik government. His son and namesake, Henry P. Davison, married Ann Stillman, daughter of James Stillman, head of the National City Bank, which handled the enormous cash flow accruing to the Standard Oil Company. H. P. also became a partner of J. P. Morgan Company. His brother, F. Truby Davison, married Dorothy Peabody, the nation's leading philanthropic family. The Peabods may be said to have invented the concept of foundation philanthropy, the first major foundation being the Peabody Education Fund, set up in 1865 by George Peabody, founder of the J.P. Morgan banking firm. It later became the Rockefeller Foundation. Dorothy Peabody's father was the renowned Endicott Peabody, founder of the establishment training school, Groton, where Franklin D. Roosevelt and many other front men were educated. Dorothy Peabody was on the national board of the American Cancer Society for many years, as well as director of Sloan Kettering. She was also a noted big game hunter, making many forays to India and Africa, and winning many trophies for her prize animals. Her husband was Secretary of War for AIR from 1926-32, and was president of the American Museum of Natural History for many years. This was Theodore Roosevelt's favorite charity. Her son, Endicott Peabody Davison, became secretary to the J.P. Morgan Company and then general manager of the London branch of the firm. He has been president of U.S. Trust since 1979, director of the defense firms Skiv Corporation and Todd Shipyards, also the Discount Corporation. He is a trustee of the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Markle Foundation, which makes key grants in the communications media. Eisenhower's Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, was also related to the Rockefellers through the Pomeroy family. The present board of managers of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center include Edward J. Beatty, a Markle scholar at George Washington University, and staff member of Rockefeller Hospital since 1978, fellow of the American Cancer Society, and chief medical officer of Memorial since 1965, Peter O. Crisp, who is manager of investments for the Rockefeller Family Associates, Harold Fisher, chairman of Exxon Corporation, the flag bearer of the Rockefeller fortune, Clifton C. Garvin, junior president of Exxon Corporation, director of Citicorp, Citibank, the former National Citibank, PepsiCo, J. C. Penny, TRW, Equitable Life, Corning Glass, and the drug firm Johnson & Johnson, Louis V. Gerstner, junior president of the giant Squibb drug firm, director of American Express, Caterpillar and Melville Corporation. He is a member of the visiting committee at Harvard University, Elmore C. Patterson, with J.P. Morgan since 1935, married Anne Hicho 8, of New York's leading legal family. Patterson is treasurer of Memorial Sloan Kettering. He is also a trustee of Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which was formerly headed by Alger Hiss, Patterson's brother-in-law, Arthur H. Cho 8, Jr. was a partner of J.P. Morgan Company for some years. He then joined Clark Dodge and Company. Robert V. Russo, partner of the investment bankers Brown Brothers Harriman, a Rhodes Scholar who was the mastermind of the Federal Reserve System for many years, training Paul Volcker and then nominating him to be chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors in Washington. Russo also helped David Rockefeller set up the Trilateral Commission, of which he remains a director. Ben O. C. Schmidt, managing partner of the investment bankers J. H. Whitney Company for many years, which has large holdings in Schlumberger, Freeport Minerals, and CBS. Schmidt was general counsel of the War Production Board during World War II, and managed the Office of Foreign Liquidation in 1945 and 1946, which disposed of billions of dollars worth of material at giveaway prices. Schmidt was on the President's Cancer Panel from 1971 to 80. He is a director of General Motors Cancer Research Foundation, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the Whitney Museum. He received the Cleveland Award for Distinguished Service in the Crusade for Cancer Control from the American Cancer Society in 1972. These groups are always awarding each other honors and prizes. No one else need apply. Schmidt also received the Bristol Myers Award for Distinguished Service in Cancer Research in 1979. His son, Benno Schmidt, Jr., married the boss daughter, Helen Cushing Whitney, and is now president of Yale University. He had served as law clerk to Chief Justice Warren at the Supreme Court and later held the office of legal counsel to the Department of Justice. Other members of the Board of Managers are H. Virgil Sherrill, president of the investment firm Baich Halsey Stewart Shields, which is now Prudential Baich, Frank Stts, director of Organon, the Ogden Corporation, both of which are chemical firms. He has been chairman of the Key Political Group, the Institute for Strategic Studies, since 1975. Stts is on the board of the National Cancer Advisory Board and the Rockefeller Foundation. He also serves on the Belgian American Educational Foundation, which was set up by Herbert Hoover after World War I to conceal his profits from his Belgian charitable work. Stts also serves on the board of the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, which had assets of $105 million in 1985, and from which it spent only $71.2 million in its charitable work. William S. Sneath, president of the giant chemical firm Union Carbide Corporation, which has had several accidents in its chemical factories in recent years. He is also a director of Metropolitan Life, controlled by the Morgan Interests, Rockwell International, and the giant advertising firm, JWT Group. Lewis Thomas, whose exploits take up a full column in Who's Who, he is investment counselor for the Rockefeller Institute, dean of the medical school at Yale, professor of medicine at Cornell since 1973. Thomas is a director of the drug firm Squibb, president emeritus of Memorial Sloan Kettering, director of the Rand Institute, Rockefeller University, John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, Menninger Foundation, Lounsbury Foundation, the Sydney Farber Cancer Institute, and the Aaron Diamond Foundation. J. S. Wickerham, who is vice president of the Morgan Bank, Morgan Guarantee Trust, Harper Woodward, who is with the Rockefeller Family Associates, longtime associate of Lawrence Rockefeller. This is only the Board of Managers of Memorial Sloan Kettering, the nation's preeminent cancer center. Each person on the Board of Managers shows many direct or indirect links with the Rockefeller interests. The center's Board of Overseers includes Mrs. Elma Bobst, widow of the prominent drug manufacturer and reorganizer of the American Cancer Society, Dr. James B. Fisk, chairman of Bell Telephone Laboratories, director of American Synonymid, Corning, Equitable Life, John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, Chase Manhattan Bank, the Rockefeller Bank, Board of Overseers at Harvard, and director of the Cabot Corporation, Richard M. Furlord, chairman of the giant drug firm Squibb, director and general counsel of Olin Corporation, the huge munitions manufacturer, and director of American Express. Dr. Emmanuel Rubin Paya, born in Wilno, Russia, headed the Special Weapons Group at the U.S. Navy 1942-46, head of the Navy Electronics Bureau 1948, director of research at IBM since 1956, professor at Rockefeller University, consultant to Mitt and Harvard, director of Paul Revere Investors, director of Sloan Kettering since 1976. He received the Kaplan Award from Hebrew University. His wife Noor Khan is a long-standing health analyst with the New York City Health Department since 1957, director of the Commonwealth Fund, Blue Cross Senior Fellow, United Hospital Fund, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, of the drug firm Johnson & Johnson, Pew Memorial Trust, Vera Foundation, Urban League, grantee from U.S. Public Health Service, James D. Robinson E., chairman of American Express, which has now incorporated both Kuhn, Loeb Company and Lehman Brothers investment banking houses into Shearson Lehman Hutton. He was formerly with Morgan Guarantee Trust, and is now director of Bristol-Myers Drug Firm, Coca-Cola, Fireman's Fund Insurance, chairman of Memorial Sloan Kettering, and Rockefeller University. James S. Rockefeller, director of Cranston Print Works, Lawrence Rockefeller, who is director of Reader's Digest with 18 million circulation and National Geographic with 10 million circulation, meaning that he influences 28 million middle-class American homes each month. Dr. Alf Moss, former public relations director of Memorial Sloan Kettering, noted that Reader's Digest is often a barometer of orthodox thinking on the cancer problem. The Rockefellers remain the most prominent contributors to Memorial Sloan Kettering. William Rockefeller is also an overseer. He is a partner of Shearson Sterling, lawyers for the Rockefeller interests. He is also a director of Cranston Print Works and Oneida Limited T.F. Warkowicz, who serves with the Rockefeller Family Associates. He is chairman of National Aviation and Technology Corporation, CHI, ITEC and MITRE Corporation, Safetrans Systems and Quadron Systems, Arthur B. Trimmon, junior managing director of Dillon Reed Investment Bankers for many years. Not only do the boards of Memorial Sloan Kettering have direct ties to the Rockefellers, they are also closely linked with defense industries, the CIA, and chemical and drug firms. It is no accident that they serve on the board of an institution whose recommendations on cancer treatment mean literally billions in profits to those who are in the right position to take advantage of them. And you thought this was a charitable organization. The fact is, the Memorial Sloan Kettering and the American Cancer Society are the principal organizational functionaries, with the American Medical Association, of the Rockefeller medical monopoly. In 1944, the American Society for the Control of Cancer changed its name to American Cancer Society. It was then placed in the hands of two of the most notorious patent medicine hucksters in the United States, Albert Lasker and Elmer Bobst. Albert Lasker, born in Freiburg, Germany, 1880 to 1952, has been called the father of modern advertising. He focused on easily remembered slogans and constant repetition to drill his messages into the heads of the American people. Like other successful hucksters memorialized in these pages, he began his career as a journalist. He was brought to this country by his parents, who settled in Galveston, Texas. His father, Morris Lasker, became a representative for Rothschild banking interests, and soon became the president of five banks in Texas. He lived in a luxurious mansion in Galveston, was a prominent grain and cotton dealer, and because of extensive interests in West Texas, he became known as the Godfather of the Panhandle. He died in 1916, leaving his son Albert as his executor. Needing cash to expand his advertising business, Albert Lasker hurriedly sold the lands at a bargain price, which in 1916 was not very much. His business acumen failed him here, because more than $1 billion of oil was later discovered on those lands. At the age of 16, Albert Lasker became a reporter on the Galveston News. He soon moved on to a better paying position in Dallas, on the Dallas Morning News, the largest newspaper in Texas. He soon found that the real money in the newspaper business was not in journalism, but in advertising, which brought in most of the revenue. Lasker went to Chicago, where he talked his way into a position with Lord & Thomas, the city's largest agency. He was only 19 years old. Because he had agreed that his salary depended on how much business he could bring into the firm, he became a fanatical hustler. At the age of 25, he had saved enough money, together with his family's money, to buy 25% of the agency. At that time, he was earning $1,000 a week. The President of the United States was then paid $10,000 a year. At the age of 30, Lasker bought the entire agency. He went on to participate in some of the most memorable advertising campaigns in the history of the business. He built a $3.5 million estate in the exclusive suburb of Lake Forest, Mill Road Farm, a 480-acre spread with 27 buildings, and a $1 million golf course which Bob Jones described as one of the three best golf courses in the United States. At the age of 42, he had arrived. The estate employed 50 workers, who kept 6 miles of hedges clipped each week. The French chateau in the center of all this luxury was more magnificent than anything built by his crusty neighbors, who viewed him with ill-disguised dislike. For years, he was the only Jewish resident, and he delighted in bruiting it about that he intended to leave the estate in his will as a Jewish community center. Lasker was always very active in major Jewish organizations, serving on the American Jewish Committee and the powerful Anti-Defamation League. His sister Florine founded the National Council of Jewish Women and the Civil Liberties Committee in New York. Another sister, Etta Rosenzohn, was a passionate Zionist who headed the Hadassah organization. During the First World War, Lasker had been persuaded by his friend Bernard Baruch to join Woodrow Wilson's cabinet as an assistant secretary. This was to be his only government post. Despite the fact that he had built Lord & Thomas into a giant advertising agency, he felt that Chicago was too small for him. He soon moved his headquarters to New York. When he joined the agency, it had only $900,000 a year income, of which a third came from one product, Cascarettes, a laxative. After he moved to New York, he realized that he was in a position to launch national campaigns to sell products whose stocks would then greatly increase in value. He cunningly invested large sums in products which had not yet gained wide public acceptance, his most notable triumph being his promotion of Kotex. The press had long had a phobia about any mention of Kotex, and it was seldom advertised. Lasker bought $1 million worth of International Cellulose, its manufacturer, and then launched a tremendous campaign in newspapers and magazines. He made many millions in profits on this one operation. Not only did he charge the firm for his advertising campaign, but he also reaped millions from the stock operation. He repeated this formula with other products, amassing a fortune of $50 million. He later boasted that, "No one has taken as much money out of advertising as I have." Lasker was behind many of the nation's most successful radio shows. He auditioned Bob Hope, and launched him on a 60-year career. It was Lasker who made Amos and Andy the most popular radio show in the United States. He hired them for Pepsodent because he said that the half of the American population who listened to the show each evening would be envisioning the white teeth flashing in those dusky countenances. The sponsor of the show was Pepsodent toothpaste. Although the program is now denigrated as offensive to American blacks, if Lasker were still alive, he would push it as the nation's most successful television show. Lasker owned the Chicago Cubs, and was a heavy gambler. He was known to bet as much as $40,000 on a single golf match. He also was a hard-driving taskmaster. In the Depression year of 1931, he had a personal profit of $1 million. This did not dissuade him from cutting back the expenses of his business. He took advantage of the widespread unemployment and the Depression to fire 50 people from the staff of Lord & Thomas. Those who remained had their salaries cut by 50%. One of Lasker's most successful promotions was his campaign to popularize drinking orange juice for the Sunkist Company. He is best remembered, however, for his association with American Tobacco's George Washington Hill. When Lasker came onto the scene, Percival Hill was still the firm's president. The son of a prominent Philadelphia banker, he had built up a successful carpet business, which he sold, investing the proceeds in a tobacco company, Blackwell Tobacco. He then sold this firm to the tobacco king, James Duke. Duke reorganized the firm in 1911 and asked Hill to become president. His son, George Washington Hill, became vice president. Lasker got the account after World War I, when tobacco manufacturers were very conservative in their advertising expenditures. They rarely spent large sums promoting a single brand, preferring to advertise their entire line. Lasker persuaded the Hills to concentrate their advertising, and to increase their budget. They did so and sales skyrocketed. In a single year, Lasker increased their advertising budget from $1 million to $25 million. He managed to maintain good relations with the arrogant and domineering George Washington Hill, whose crudeness was memorialized by Sidney Greenstreet in the film, The Hucksters. Greenstreet portrayed Hill as a loathsome slob who made his point by spitting a great gob on the table in front of his directors. Lasker created the catchy slogan for Lucky Strikes, "It's toasted." When World War II began, he tried to foist a supposedly patriotic slogan on the American public, "Lucky Strike Green has gone to war." The campaign was a flop. It was a flimsy pretext that the green color used in the package had been requisitioned for the war effort. Lasker's greatest achievement was his national campaign to persuade women to smoke in public. He could be said to be the father of women's lung cancer. At that time, few women were bold enough to be seen smoking in public. Ably assisted by his minions in Hollywood, Lasker saw to it that in many scenes of movies, leading women would be seen smoking cigarettes in public. His greatest success was through Bette Davis, who delivered her lines in almost every scene through a thick cloud of smoke. Smoking in public now became common, creating a vast new market for cigarettes, which, of course, was Lasker's only goal. Some 20 years later, many of these women were dying from emphysema or lung cancer. Lasker's furious pace took its toll. He had three nervous breakdowns, but his greatest shock came when his wife died in 1936. He met an actress the following year, Doris Kenyon, and impulsively married her. The marriage lasted only a few months. She went back to Hollywood, divorced him, and married the brother-in-law of pianist Arthur Rubinstein, which proved to be a successful marriage. In 1939, while lunching with Wild Bill Donovan at the 21 Club, who was soon to become head of the wartime OSS, later the CIA, he was introduced to an attractive divorcee, an art dealer named Mary Woodard. The daughter of a Wisconsin banker, she had started a dress company, Hollywood Patterns, designing inexpensive dresses for working girls, and then had gone into the art business. A few days later, while he was lunching with publisher Richard Simon, he met her a second time, and decided to marry her. He was just starting to build an art collection and knew very little about painting. He later claimed he had married her to save $1 million in sales commissions, which he probably did. She tried to get him to relax, and soon had him going to a psychoanalyst. He was lunching with Richard Simon again when he jumped up and said, "I'm late for my psychoanalyst." Simon seemed puzzled, and Lasker explained, "I'm doing it to get rid of all the hate the advertising business has put into me." It is likely that he had put more hate in advertising business than it had put into him. Despite the fact that practically all of his close friends were prominent Jews, such as Bernard Baruch, Anna Rosenberg, David Sarnoff, the New York publicist Bensonberg, and Louis Strauss of Kuhn, Loeb Company, he rarely hired Jews in his advertising firm. When he was reproached for this, he merely smiled, and said, "Look, I went into this firm and took it over. Do you think I want somebody to do that to me?" Among his protégés were very successful advertising men such as Emerson Foote, William Benton and Fairfax Cohn, all of whom were Gentiles. Lasker liked to call them his little goyim. He joked about how he could make them jump when he barked. In 1942, Lasker, having made a large fortune, decided to close down Lord & Thomas. His protégés went on to found the firm of Fairfax Cohn and Belding. William Edward, a lawyer, had married Carla, the daughter of Bernard Gimble of the department store Fortune. At the wedding, Lasker duly cited an old Jewish proverb, "You can't make an omelette from two spoiled eggs." He was proven right, they got a divorce. His daughter, Mary, married the Chicago steel tycoon, Lee Block, of Inland Steel. They amassed a multi-million dollar art collection. She also became a vice president of Foote, Cohn and Belding. Block's brother Joseph became president of the Jewish Federation. Lasker had grown bored with wearing white shirts. He started the vogue of wearing blue shirts in New York, which became the hallmark of the advertising profession. He never learned to drive a car, and had no mechanical skills. After moving to New York, he begrudged the enormous upkeep of his Lake Forest estate. In 1939 he donated it to the University of Chicago. The trustees promptly sold it off for building lots, The million-dollar mansion went for $110,000. Lasker's importance to this narrative is the fact that he and his cohort, a patent medicine huckster named Elmer Bobst, took the American Cancer Society, a moribund group in the early 1940s, and within months built it into a powerful national force. They used all their techniques for promotion, fundraising and business organization to make this group the most powerful force in the new billion-dollar world of cancer treatment, an achievement for which the Rockefeller medical monopoly was extremely grateful. They summarily dumped a cumbersome organization known as the Women's Army, which was very decentralized, and placed all the power of the American Cancer Society in New York. All of its meetings are held there. They also used their business connections to bring in a new board of trustees from the biggest names in banking and industry, charging $100,000 each for the privilege of serving on the board. After launching the American Cancer Society as a viable organization, Lasker himself became ill with cancer. He was operated on for intestinal cancer in 1950, not knowing that cutting into a cancer immediately spreads it throughout the body. He died in 1952 at the Harkness Rockefeller Pavilion. Before his death, he had set up the Albert and Mary Lasker Foundation, which was to make Mary Lasker the most powerful woman in American medicine. She soon controlled a vast empire of grants, foundations, Washington lobbyists and other organizations. Her most able lieutenant in achieving this power was the Rockefeller employee, Anna Rosenberg, who has worked closely with her for years. Elmer Bobst, who was Lasker's partner in putting the American Cancer Society over the top, was also a tycoon. Unlike Lasker, Bobst had come from a poor family, but he also had the born huckster's mentality, taken from that Native American entrepreneur, P.T. Barnum, who said, "There's a sucker born every minute." Bobst joined the drug firm of Hoffman LaRoche in 1911, where his talents as a salesman got him the presidency of the firm. He was also a shrewd businessman, just after World War I, knowing that commodity prices were bound to fall. He was shocked to find that the firm had accumulated huge inventories in the New Jersey warehouse. He quickly closed a deal with Eastman Kodak to buy 5 tons of bromides, a key ingredient not only of analgesics but also of photographic supplies. He offered the bromides at 60 cents a pound, 10 cents below the market price. Within a few weeks, the market price had fallen to 16 cents a pound. Bobst's great achievement at Hoffman LaRoche was his advertising campaign for vitamins. It was so successful that he won the nickname of the Vitamin King. He made millions of dollars in the stock market, and he decided to leave Hoffman LaRoche for greener pastures. In 1944, he called in Cravath, Swain & Moore, the lawyers for Kuhn, Loeb Company, to negotiate his terms. They got him a very favorable settlement of $150,000 the first year and $60,000 a year until his 75th birthday. Having made his fortune in peddling vitamins, he now moved on to the higher-priced pills, becoming head of Warner Lambert. This firm's biggest product was Listerine. Gerald Lambert, no mean huckster himself, had built Lambert Pharmacal into a giant empire, principally through his relentless warnings about the perils of bad breath. His father had invented a mouthwash, for which he appropriated the most famous name in medicine, Baron Joseph Lister, the inventor of antiseptics and asepsis in hospitals. A prominent surgeon, Baron Lister had operated on Queen Victoria herself, the only time she submitted to the knife. Gerald Lambert made his name a household word with four-page advertisements for Listerine. Banner headlines warned that, "Even your best friend won't tell you." Lambert coined a new word for this plague, halitosis, from the Latin for bad breath. At the height of the 1920s stock market boom, Gerald Lambert sold his firm to the Warner Corporation for $25 million, the equivalent of $500 million in 1980. The deal was closed in 1928. Within a year, the value of the firm had dropped to $5 million. The resulting Warner-Lambert Corporation had showed little growth during the 1930s. Bobst was hired primarily for his marketing skills, but he soon proved that he was an empire builder, buying more than 50 additional companies. In an astute move, he named Albert Driscoll president of the firm. Driscoll had just served 7 years as governor of New Jersey. As directors, Bobst brought in the shrewdest brains on Wall Street, Sidney Weinberg of Goldman Sachs, and Frederick Eberstadt, of Eberstadt & Company. As director of public relations, he brought in Anna Rosenberg, who had long been director of labor relations for the Rockefellers at their primary holding Rockefeller Center. This meant that Bobst had now established a key Rockefeller connection, as Anna Rosenberg continued to have a close association with her former employers. Because he was the only one who was aware of his ambitious plans, Bobst had bought heavily into Warner-Lambert stock before he began his great expansion. As a result, the stock increased many times in value. He was now the largest stockholder, worth many millions. Fortune described his senile lifestyle, his vast estates in New Jersey, his 87-foot yacht at Spring Lake, and his suite at the Waldorf. In fact, Bobst owned 5 yachts in succession, each one larger than the last, and all named Alisa, the last being called Alisa V. He also married a second time, marrying the Lebanese delegate to the United Nations. He was chairman of the War Bond Drive in New Jersey during World War II, and became a large contributor to political campaigns. He thus became a very influential behind-the-scenes figure in the Republican Party, so much so that he chose his own man for the presidency. Eisenhower's Secretary of the Treasury, George Humphrey, of the Rothschild Bank, National City Bank of Cleveland, had been slated to speak at a fundraising rally in New Jersey of which Bobst was chairman. He became ill, and Vice President Richard Nixon was sent in his place. This began a close relationship between Bobst and Nixon, which was almost a father-son relationship. Nixon was dazzled by Bobst's millionaire lifestyle, and he saw to it that the Bobsts were frequently invited to the White House dinners. In 1957, Nixon was able to introduce Bobst to the Queen of England at a White House gathering. After Nixon's ill-advised, if justified, attack on the press after his campaign in California, it seemed that his political career was over. However, Bobst was not about to give up on such a potential ally. Nixon later fondly recalled the best advice Bobst ever gave him. Bobst had drawn him aside, during what was a period of great depression for Nixon, and earnestly told him, "Dick, it's time you learned the facts of life. You see, there are really only 2 kinds of people in the world, the eaters and the eaten. You just have to make up your mind which group you're going to be in." At a time when Nixon had little or no prospects, Bobst went to his attorney, Matt Herold, the senior partner of the Wall Street firm of Mudge, Rose and Stern. Warner-Lambert was their biggest client, and when Bobst suggested to Herold that he bring in Nixon from California as a partner of the firm, Herold was only too happy to oblige. With this springboard, Nixon was able to launch his successful campaign for the presidency. The move turned out to be a wise investment all around. After Nixon won the election, the Republican governors of the states of New Jersey, Nebraska, Kentucky, and West Virginia turned over all of their tax-free bond business to Mudge Rose, giving the firm an additional $1 million a year of income. In January of 1971, Mudge Rose appeared before the Justice Department on the matter of the merger of Warner-Lambert and Park Davis, a decision which meant millions of dollars to Bobst. Attorney General John Mitchell, also a protege of Bobst, disqualified himself. His Deputy Attorney General, Richard Kleindienst, then let the merger go through. These were the only deals which became a matter of public knowledge, no doubt there were many more. In a brilliant tax move, Mitchell advised Bobst to donate $11 million to New York University for the Bobst Library. In 1973, Bobst had his autobiography published by David Mackay Company in New York. An obvious puff job, it was a glowing account of Bobst's accomplishments, unmarred by any unfavorable comments. When Bobst died in 1978, no obituary appeared in the New York Times. This was an amazing circumstance concerning one of New York's most prominent tycoons. The Times routinely memorialized even the minor executives of New York firms. Strangely enough, a public statement about Bobst did appear in the Times, a memorial eulogy by his longtime friend, Lawrence Rockefeller, the chairman of Sloan Kettering. Rockefeller said, "His efforts in the fight against cancer earned the sincere gratitude of cancer patients and researchers as well as the general public." Perhaps Bobst's real memorial is the label of Listerine, which still carries the message, "For bad breath, insect bites, infectious dandruff, 26.9% alcohol." Rockefeller was referring to Bobst's revitalization of the American Cancer Society. Under his leadership, it had obtained a new charter on June 23, 1944, and underwent a complete reorganization. The staff was expanded to 300, and the two hucksters launched a national campaign to enlist 2.5 million volunteers to patrol every foot of the nation in gathering funds to fight cancer. Because the orders to engage in this campaign always came from business tycoons, social leaders and politicians, the masses had no alternative, they had to obey. The huckster talents of Bobst and Lasker resulted in the often ludicrous spectacle of millions of peasants being herded out into the streets in an annual march to rattle tin cans and beg donations for the super rich. The only campaign to equal it probably was the annual drive by the Nazi Party in Germany for contributions for the Winterhilfe campaign. The Axe campaign operated on the same lines. The millions of volunteers threw themselves into this annual task because their jobs, their social position, and their families depended on their willingness to make the sacrifice to the god of Mammon, which was presently masquerading as the ghost of cancer's past and to come. The chairman of the American Cancer Society, Clarence D. Little, had been named to that post in 1929 by the Rockefellers, longtime associates who had established a laboratory for him at their summer home on Mount Desert Island. He seemed to have no interest in cancer, spending most of his time as president of the American Birth Control League, the Euthanasia Society, and the Eugenics Society, the latter being a pet project of the Harriman family. He admitted that in 1943, the American Cancer Society spent nothing on research. Little had been president of the University of Michigan, and now served as overseer of Harvard University. Under his leadership, the cancer group had been nothing more than a small group of elitists who met occasionally in New York. Despite its reorganization on a more business-like basis, the American Cancer Society, long after the Littles' departure, continued to pile up a stunning record of non-accomplishment. One critic, a longtime federal official, publicly stated that it should be called the Infantile Society for National Paralysis. However, the society's inability to find a cure for cancer was hardly accidental. The Bobst-Lasker influence brought it firmly into the orbit of the Sloan Kettering Institute, whose motto had long been, "Millions for research, but not one cent for a cure." Charles McCabe, the irreverent columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, wrote on September 27, 1971, "You might be wondering if the personnel of the American Cancer Society, or cancer research foundations, and other sounded organizations, are truly interested in a cure for cancer. Or whether they would like a problem which supports them to continue to exist." The new Bobst-Lasker board of the American Cancer Society featured the usual array of Rockefeller cohorts: Anna Rosenberg, Eric Johnston, longtime head of the Chamber of Commerce and now head of the Motion Picture Association, a public relations spokesman for the Hollywood moguls; John Adams, a partner of Lazard Freeriers and head of Standard Brands; General William Donovan, the Wall Street lawyer who was selected by the British Intelligence Service to head the new Office of Strategic Services, the nation's spy network, he was later sent to Thailand as U.S. ambassador to oversee the operations of the World Dope Ring, Emerson Foote, Lasker's advertising protege, Ralph Reed, the president of American Express Company, Harry Von Elm, the superbanker who was president of Manufacturers Trust, and Florence Mahoney, the multi-million-dollar heiress of the Cox newspaper fortune, and a longtime crony of Mary Lasker. In 1958, the officers of the American Cancer Society were Alfred P. Sloan, president, Monroe J. Rathbone, president of Standard Oil, Mrs. Anna Rosenborg Hoffman of the Rockefeller Foundation, General Donovan and Eric Johnston. Senator Ralph Yarborough of Texas, a perennial champion of socialized medicine, established a 26-member national panel of consultants on the conquest of cancer, chaired by Benno Schmidt, head of J. H. Whitney investment banking firm. Other members were Lawrence Rockefeller, Dr. Sidney Farber, former president of the American Cancer Society, G. Keith Funston, chairman of the Olin Munitions firm, and Mathilda J. Krim, a former Zionist terrorist. An interesting footnote to history is the revelation of the cozy relationships which developed between top Nazi officials and the founders of the Zionist terrorist network, Haganah and the Irgun Vilumi, in the closing days of the Second World War. Their Zionists were working to drive the British out of Palestine. The Nazis were also at war with England, which gave birth to the most curious political alliance of the 20th century. One of the leading advocates of working with the ABWE, German intelligence, was one Yitzhak Shamir, now Premier of Israel. After the war, the Zionists employed many former Nazis to help set up their military opposition to the British. The leader in this alliance was the veteran of the old Stern Gang of terrorists, which was now the Irgun Vilumi, none other than Menachem Begin. One of Begin's protégés was a young woman named Mathilda J. As she was known in terrorist circles. She was born in Switzerland after her father left Italy because of poor economic conditions, no political ideology there. The present Mrs. Krim is described by current biography as a geneticist and a philanthropist. She has been the resident biologist at the American Cancer Society for many years. In her younger days, she joined the Irgun Vilumi, marrying a fellow terrorist in a show of solidarity. She soon became a favorite of Begin, and divorced her husband. It was Begin who was asked by a grinning Mike Wallace on the program, 60 Minutes, "Did you really introduce terrorism into the politics of the Middle East?" Begin answered emphatically, "Not just the Middle East, the whole world." He was referring to the worldwide terrorist operations of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence group which is entirely financed by the CIA with American taxpayers' funds. Mathilda J. then went to work at the Weizmann Institute in Israel. One day, she was introduced to one of its wealthiest American directors, the movie mogul Arthur Krim. They were married, making her an American citizen. Krim has been the chief lobbyist in Washington for the major film companies for many years. He is also a principal fundraiser for the Zionist Agitprop Network. As a fundraiser, he was also a close friend of President Lyndon B. Johnson. Krim and his wife were house guests of Johnson's at the White House when the Israelis attacked the U.S. ship of the line, USS Liberty, killing many of her crew. When other American ships sent planes to aid the Liberty, immediate orders were sent from the White House for the planes to turn back. The Israelis were free to continue their attack for several more hours in a desperate attempt to sink the Liberty, to destroy the radio evidence it had gathered that the Israelis had started the Six-Day War. Although it is generally believed that Krim issued the orders for the U.S. planes to turn back, no investigation was ever made. Johnson is now dead, and they are the only living witnesses in this horrendous example of high treason from the White House. The CIA had known for 24 hours that an attack was planned against the Liberty, in the hopes of bringing the U.S. into the war on the side of Israel. Faked evidence had already been planted that the attack would come from the Egyptians. Mathilda Krim is now a director of the Rockefeller Foundation. She and her husband are directors of the Afro-American Institute. Arthur Krim has a long record of supporting left-wing causes in New York, the New York School of Social Research, the Henry Street Settlement, and the Field Foundation. Krim is chairman of United Artists, now Orion Films. As personal attorney for Armand Hammer, whose claim to fame is that he was a friend of the blood-soaked terrorist, Lenin, Krim is also a director of Hammer's two principal firms, Iowa Beef and Occidental Petroleum. Krim also served as chairman of the Democratic Finance Committee, he is chairman of the Board of Trustees of Columbia University, and director of the Lyndon B. Johnson Foundation. Critics noted in 1976 that at least 18 members of the American Cancer Society's board of directors were executive officers of banks. Axe spent $114 million that year, but had assets of $181 million. As of August 31, 1976, 42% of Axe cash and investments, some $75 million, was being held in banks with which these officers were affiliated. The 1975 budget of Axe reported that 570 went for administration. The amount allocated for research was less than the salaries of its 2,900 employees. The American Cancer Society, for all practical purposes, controlled the National Cancer Institute, a government agency. Former NCI director Frank J. Rauska became the senior vice president of Axe, with his salary doubled to $75,000 a year. An Axe spokesman admitted that 70% of its 1,976 research budget went to individuals or institutions with which its board members were affiliated. Pat McGrady, who served for 25 years as science editor of Axe, told writer Peter Chowker, "Medicine has become venal, second only to the law." The Axe slogan, "Control cancer with a checkup and a check. It's phony, because we are not controlling cancer." That slogan is the extent of the Axe scientific, medical and clinical savvy. Nobody in the science and medical departments there is capable of doing real science. They are wonderful professionals who know how to raise money. They don't know how to prevent cancer or cure patients. Instead, they close the door to innovative ideas. Axe money goes to scientists who put on the best show to get grants or who have friends on the grant-giving panels. This is probably the most reliable summation of what is done with your contributions to the American Cancer Society. As we pointed out earlier, it is the masses giving alms to the big rich, who know how to distribute these funds among themselves, their friends, and their favorite tax-exempt organizations, which in many cases are refuges for the more incompetent members of their families. The Axe directors are drawn from the best people in New York, the jet set, the trendy Park Avenue crowd who were caricatured by novelist Tom Wolfe as radical chic. At one time, black power was in, now it is homosexuality and cancer. This group constantly advertises itself as being obsessed with compassion and caring, which is always done with other people's money. Their own wallets remain glued to their backsides. This is exemplified by the bleeding hearts on the national news shows, who nightly regale us with their version of the homeless, the starving in Africa, or wherever they can find a photogenic victim with flies crawling on him. These journalists, who are paid millions of dollars a year, have never been known to toss their coins to these victims. In politics, its morals are exemplified by the fat, aging playboy, Senator Teddy Kennedy, in Hollywood, by the equally pudgy Elizabeth Taylor. Mathilda Krim is now the guiding genius behind the newly created American Foundation for AIDS Research. Because of her powerful Hollywood connections, she was easily able to persuade Elizabeth Taylor and other stars to raise millions for her pet project. She also recruited her old friend Mary Lasker as the first board member of AIDS. Mary Lasker paid the current advertising genius, Jerry Della Femina, to create a tasteful national ad campaign for the distribution and use of condoms. The Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center continues to be the most fashionable charity among the New York socialites. Certainly it is the most influential. It is listed on the Tony Upper East Side as the Society of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. It has operated a popular thrift shop on 3rd Avenue for many years, which is filled with donations from wealthy families. Like many other young writers and artists, the present writer purchased his clothes there for years, all of it labeled from the most expensive shops in New York. Because the fight against cancer is totally controlled by the Rockefeller medical monopoly, grants are routinely awarded which are nothing more than rip-offs. One WAG claims the axe will award a research grant only if the recipient signs a paper swearing he will not find a cure for cancer. Although only the tip of the iceberg has been revealed, there have been numerous exposes attesting that most of the cancer research is bogus, replete with faked results. In one of the more publicized incidents, the National Cancer Institute gave $980,000 to a researcher at Boston University, who was forced to resign after charges that he had falsified his research data. Another well-known incident at the August Memorial Center itself found that mice were painted different colors in order to verify certain cancer tests. Dr. William Sumlin of Sloan Kettering admitted painting the mice to make them look as though successful skin grafts had been done. The National Bureau of Standards reports that half or more of the numerical data published by scientists in articles in the journal is unusable because there is no evidence that the researchers accurately measured what they thought they were measuring. Alarmed by these statistics, officials instituted a survey. 31 authors of scientific reports were sent questionnaires asking for their raw data. The 21 who replied said that their data had been lost or accidentally destroyed. What a loss to the research profession. The reliability of the nation's researchers wilted under a blistering expose on 60 Minutes, on January 17, 1988, under the title, The Facts Were Fiction. The subject of the expose was one of the leading scientific scholars in the nation. He had claimed to have done extensive research on the mentally retarded at a state institution, where the records clearly showed that he had only worked on goldfish. The 60 Minutes report estimated that from 10% to 30% of all research projects carried out in the United States is totally faked, because of the requirements to win the grantsmanship race. Startling results must be claimed before serious consideration is given to requests for funding, which themselves are hardly niggardly amounts. They often amount to grants of millions of dollars. One scientific scholar who was interviewed on 60 Minutes declared that, "I would think twice before I believe what I read in the medical journals. It is dishonest, fraudulent information." The moving spirit behind all this fakery is the unwillingness of the big rich to see their profits imperiled by any genuine advances in medicine. Therefore, the more fake research that is done, the less chance that a drug now on the market which is bringing in $100 million a year or more will be knocked off the market. The wholesale fakery in American research is almost entirely due to the pressures of the Rockefeller medical monopoly and the drug firms under their control, who routinely present elaborately faked tests to the Food and Drug Administration to obtain approval for new products, concealing harmful side effects, which often include liver and kidney damage, or death. The control of the universities by the medical monopoly creates a breeding ground for more robotic minions, willing to abase themselves in any manner for a grant or a job which requires little or no performance. A lengthy history of faked research is an ideal Panama or control to keep these minions in line. It is frightening to contemplate that such faked research is usually the basis for the acceptance or denial of new drugs, while protecting the establishment as it continues to reap more profits from long outmoded and discredited panaceas and procedures. Yet this is the background, as well as the raison d'etre, for President Reagan's brave new budget for 1989, which sets aside $64.6 billion for research and development. although this is only a 4% increase over 1988, it represents a 52% increase since Reagan took office. The National Institute of Health budget has doubled to $6.2 billion. Cancer research will receive $1.5 billion, while AIDS is earmarked for an expenditure of $2 billion. Mathilda Krim must be very happy. Critics have pointed out that Memorial Sloan Kettering had done practically no research on the prevention of cancer, only on its favored modes of treatment. The basic premise of its research is that the cell is solely responsible for the multiplication of cancer cells is probably erroneous. However, it is the basis for all of their work, including their promotion of chemotherapy. In fact, the cell is probably reacting to outside infection or pressures, and the fault is not in the cell. The Sloan-Kettering approach dangles the promise of a magic bullet, which will bring the cell back to a healthy regimen through medication or chemotherapy. The chemotherapy drugs include alkylating agents which actually inhibit cell growth. They are alkaloids, which hinder cell mitosis or cell division. Sloan-Kettering also bypasses the possibility of stimulating the immune system to respond to cancer growth, which is the normal method which the body uses to fight disease. This institution receives $70 million a year from various tax-exempt foundations, including the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, which means that the American taxpayer is subsidizing all of this research. 130 full-time scientists are doing research at the center. All 345 physicians at the center are also heavily involved in research. And what are the results of all this activity? A continued reliance on the now antiquated cut, slash and burn techniques still redolent of the mad doctor practices of the late doctors J. Marvin Sims and James Ewing, dead these many years. While wedded to the ritual observance of these expensive, painful and futile procedures, the scientists at Sloan-Kettering maintain a resolute phalanx of opinion denouncing various holistic procedures which rely on diet, nutrition and vitamins. Dr. Muriel Shimkin of the National Institute of Health wrote in the Institute's official primer on cancer in 1973 that treatment of cancer by diet alone is in the realm of quackery. Yet the American Cancer Society, faced with a growing amount of evidence to the contrary, issued a special report in 1984 advising the following program: 1. Avoid obesity. 2. Cut down total fat intake to 30% of total calories. 3. Eat more high-fiber foods. 4. Eat foods rich in vitamins A and C. 5. Include cruciferous vegetables in the diet, greens, etc. 6. Be moderate in the consumption of alcohol. 7. Moderate consumption of salt-cured, smoked and nitrite-cured foods. This is a very sensible regimen, however, it has not been emphasized by the ACTS or the NIT, nor do many doctors include this advice in their recommendations to their patients. The American Cancer Society has always had one bugaboo: letrile. Dr. Lewis Thomas, longtime head of Sloan-Kettering, told the American Cancer Society Science Writers Seminar on April 2, 1975, letrile had absolutely no value in combating cancer. This contradicted the work done by the center's own scientists, whose real results had been suppressed. Dr. Thomas stated again in 1975, letrile has been shown, after 2 years of tests, to be worthless in fighting cancer. Dr. Robert Good, president of Sloan-Kettering, had also stated in January 1974, at this moment there is no evidence that letrile has an effect on cancer. His own scientists had completed studies which showed the opposite. Two researchers, Dr. Lloyd Sohn and Dr. Elizabeth Srockett, both working independently at the center, had found that pineapple enzymes combined with letrile resulted in total tumor regression in 50% of their experiments on 34 experimental animals there. One of the most famous beneficiaries of the letrile treatment was the actor, Steve McQueen. He had been given up by his physicians as a terminal case when he tried letrile. He was responding well until a physician persuaded him to undergo surgery on a tumor. He then died on the operating table of an embolism. The establishment proclaimed that this proved the Letrile treatment was worthless. Harold Manner, at the Cancer Center, also found a combination of Letrile, enzymes and vitamin A had a similar positive effect on mice with cancer. Dr. Kinemates Yasuigi Ira, who had been at Memorial since 1917, after earlier working on cancer at the Harriman Institute, had also produced striking results proving that Letrile was effective on cancer in experimental animals. On June 13, 1973, the results of cancer tests using Letrile by Dr. Kinemates Yasuigi Ira over a period of 9 months stated, "The results clearly show that amygdalin significantly inhibits the appearance of lung metastasis in mice." Although this had been announced by the Sloan Kettering Institute, on January 10, 1974, Dr. Robert Good, president of Sloan Kettering, denounced the news of the findings as a premature leak. Dr. Ralph Moss, who was then public relations director at the Cancer Center, considered Suigu Ira's work a genuine breakthrough and a welcome departure from Sloan Kettering's singular lack of success in its cancer work. On November 17, 1977, he held a press conference at the Hilton Hotel in New York. Instead of receiving praise for publicizing the success at the center, he was fired the next day. He later wrote an excellent book, The Cancer Syndrome, which exposes many of the strange events at Sloan Kettering. His book is very factual, and is written without rancor against those who had thrown him out. Because Elmer Bobst had played the crucial role in making it possible for Nixon to become president, he had little trouble in persuading Nixon to authorize a new and expensive war on cancer. At Bobst's instigation, Nixon signed the National Cancer Act in 1971. Which transformed the National Cancer Institute at Bethesda into a new monolithic government bureaucracy. During the next 15 years, NCAR was to spend more than $10 billion funding various cancer programs, none of which had any effect in curing or preventing cancer. In 1955, NCAR had established a chemotherapy national service center with a $25 million grant to promote the use of chemotherapy. A four-page advertisement in the New York Times, December 9, 1969, proclaimed that cancer cure is near at hand. The story promised that a cancer cure by 1976 was a distinct possibility. The chairman of the President's National Cancer Panel submitted a report admitting that the first 5 years of the National Cancer Program was a failure. The cancer toll had risen during each year of its operation. By 1985, the annual toll was 485,000 victims. More than 43,000 people deluged Nixon with demands that the NCI test Letrile. Benno Schmidt then chose a panel of scientists to make the tests. All of them were known to be fanatically opposed to Letrile. When he asked for the scientific results, he said, "I couldn't get anybody to show me his work." Had their tests shown Letrile to be worthless, they would have been only too happy to publish their findings. The battle against Letrile continued on a nationwide campaign. One lobbyist, Charles Afso, had a full-time job in Sacramento, California, lobbying against Letrile. He was paid $25,000 a year. Drugstore proprietors who displayed books favorable to Letrile were informed that no member of the EMA would henceforth send them prescriptions until these books were removed. Since 1963, the Federal Trade Commission has brought pressure against publishers of pro-Letrile books. Government statutes not only prohibit the interstate shipment of Letrile, but even of books which recommend it. After chiropractic, Letrile was the most important target of the criminal syndicalist operation of the Coordinating Conference of Health Information, the conspiracy launched by the American Cancer Society, the American Medical Association, and the Food and Drug Administration. It continued to be mostly a war of censorship and intimidation, whose goal was to prevent any public discussion of Letrile. TV shows which scheduled forums on Letrile, to discuss both sides of the controversy, were suddenly cancelled. Tests showing the effectiveness of Letrile were suppressed, they never reached the public. The desperation of the campaign against Letrile was solely financial, it represented the greatest threat to the profits of the Rockefeller medical monopoly. Hospital treatment for cancer cost many thousands of dollars. Despite the Cancer Center's $70 million a year for research, its Memorial Hospital charged $470 a day for a bed. A 10-day stay would be nearly $5,000, with another $4,000 charged for treatment and physician care. The record of the cut, slash and burn treatments were routinely distorted and falsified. Dr. Hardin James, professor of medical physics at the University of California at Berkeley, addressed the Axe Science Writers Conference in 1969. He revealed that the worst cancer cases were usually termed inoperable and deliberately left untreated. The published cancer studies of cures or remissions were the sweetheart cases, which had a high rate of recovery. Nevertheless, Dr. James reported, the life expectancy of these untreated cases was actually greater than the life expectancy of those who were treated. Despite Dr. James' revelations, the hospitals continued to pick and choose which cases of cancer they would treat. Even the esteemed Cancer Center noted that its policy is not to accept some terminal cases. The patients are politely referred to a death hospice where they can die. In fact, such turnaways may have been a boon to the dying, as the treatment they would have undergone at Memorial Hospital would have made Count Dracula drool with envy. Dr. Ralph Moss revealed some of the prevalent surgical techniques there. He reported that cancer of the head and neck was treated by an operation called the commando after a combat technique used by commandos in the Second World War. It called for the entire removal of the jaw. Pancreatic cancer was treated by removal of most of the area organs near the infected gland. The survival rate, despite this drastic treatment, remained the same, a mere 3%. In 1948, Dr. Alex Brunschvig invented an operation called total excinteration, which called for the removal of the rectum, stomach, bladder, liver, ureter, all internal reproductive organs, the pelvic floor and wall, pancreas, spleen, colon and many blood vessels. Dr. Brunschvig himself called this hollowing out technique a brutal and cruel procedure. New York Times, August 8, 1969. The epitome of the mad doctor operations was known as a hemicorporectomy. Originated by Dr. Theodore Miller at the Cancer Center, it involved cutting off everything below the pelvis. These techniques are more than reminiscent of certain procedures used by communist revolutionaries in Latin America. The Sandinist revolutionaries were inspired by their leader's poetic dictum that liberty is not conquered with flowers, but with bullets, and that is why we use the vest cut, the gourd cut, and the bloomer's gut. In the vest cut, the victim's head was lopped off with a machete and his arms were severed at the shoulders. In the gourd cut, the victim had the top of his head lopped off. The bloomer's cut called for hacking both legs off at the knees, leaving the victim to bleed to death. The records of the mad doctor syndrome would fill several books. One special congressional report followed some 31 human guinea pig experiments over a 30-year period. The committee, chaired by Woodward D. Markey, D. Marr, gave his comment that his findings shock the conscience and represent a black mark on the history of medical research. The report showed that from 1945 to 1947, in the Manhattan Project, scientists routinely injected 18 patients with plutonium. From 1961 to 1965 at MIT, 20 elderly patients were injected with orfedradium or thorium. From 1946 to 1947 at the University of Rochester, 6 patients who had good kidneys were injected with uranium salts to determine the concentration that might produce kidney injury. From 1953 to 1957 at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, 12 patients were injected with uranium to determine the dosage that would cause kidney injury. From 1963 to 1971, 67 inmates of Oregon State Prison and 64 inmates of Washington State Prison had X-rays on their testes to determine the effect of radiation on human fertility. From 1963 to 1965 at the National Reactor Test Station of the Atomic Energy Commission in Idaho, radioactive iodine was purposely released on 7 separate occasions, and 7 human subjects purposely drank milk from cows grazed on iodine-contaminated land. From 1961 to 1963 at the University of Chicago and Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois, 102 human subjects were fed fallout from the Nevada test site, with radioactive simulated fallout particles, and solutions of radioactive cesium and strontium. During the late 1950s, 12 patients at Presbyterian and Montefiore hospitals in New York were injected with radioactive calcium and strontium cancer particles. Oregon State Prison gave radium doses of 600 roentgens in single exposures on the reproductive organs, when the safe dose was 5 roentgens per year. For a decade, scientists were fed radioactive materials so that other scientists could calibrate their instruments for measuring these doses. Whatever kicks the mad doctors may have gotten from these experiments, the cancer rate remained the same, or increased. Congressman Widener pointed out that, information has been brought to my attention showing that 20 years ago, in 1957, the same proportion of cancer cases, 1 in 3, was being cured. This raises the question why, despite all the money and effort devoted to cancer research, the cure rate has remained the same. Despite such criticism, NCI continued to waste billions of dollars on worthless programs. It was reported that George R. Bettett of the University of Arizona at Tempe had spent 6 years and $100,000 extricating chemicals from 250,000 butterflies as part of an NCI program. There were no identifiable results. Other researchers continued to find the war on cancer a profitable war. The Saturday Review reported in its issue of December 2, 1961 that a prominent financial supporter of the American Cancer Society in Massachusetts was upset when he could never find the state director in his office. He was finally told that the director, James V. Lavin, was probably in his other office across the street, where he ran a private fundraising company, the James C. Lavin Company. He represented a select group of clients. Stung by this revelation, the executive vice president of the American Cancer Society, Lane W. Adams, wrote a letter to Saturday Review, June 6, 1962 as follows: "The arrangement by which James C. Lavin operated private fundraising while serving as executive director of the Massachusetts American Cancer Society was known by the National Society." Adams said that Lavin's salary was $17,000. Plus another $10,000 a year paid to his company. Saul Naglin of the Lavin Company was the controller of the Massachusetts branch of ACS for a number of years. The yearly overhead of the Massachusetts branch was $548,000 in 1960, with total income of $1.1 million. Adams' letter also boasted that, "We helped support the research of Dr. Sterling Schwartz injecting human leukemia brain extract in human subjects, Dr. Chester Soudan injecting live cancer cells beneath the skin of human beings." Adams, who had been with the American Cancer Society since 1948, now heads the national offices at 90 Park Avenue, in New York. He received the Albert Lasker Public Service Award from ACS. He is also vice president of Zion First National Bank in Salt Lake City, director of Paul Revere Investors, and the Energy Fund. Lavin's attorney, James Mount Sows, was secretary of the Massachusetts ACS and also served on the national board. In 1978, the American Cancer Society had $140 million income, of which less than 30% was spent on cancer research, with 56% going to cover administrative costs. The society had $200 million in investments. Before the Bob Stlasker takeover in 1944, its income had never gone past $600,000 a year. The following year, It raised $5 million. In 1982, Alan Sonenshine published a warning, "Watch out, the American Cancer Society may be hazardous to your health." In 1955, in a power move, Axe took over all research from the National Research Council, executing a brilliant coup by creating a new science advisory council to represent American hospitals and universities. Dr. Samuel Epstein, in his book, The Politics of Cancer, noted that, apart from being uninvolved in cancer prevention, other than, to a limited extent, tobacco, senior, Axe, officials have developed for the society a reputation of being indifferent, if not actively hostile, to regulatory needs for the prevention of exposure to carcinogenic chemicals in the general environment and in the workplace. Epstein reported that the Axe opposed regulation of such potential carcinogens as red dye hash 2, trees, and day. Axe refused to support the Clean Water Act, and blamed victims for cancer. EPA had reported that indoor pollutants cause 6,000 cancer deaths a year and that 38 million Americans drink water with unsafe levels of lead and other toxic matter, including chlorine byproducts. Diethylstilbestrol was widely used from the 1940s to the early 1970s as a synthetic female hormone which was routinely prescribed by doctors to prevent miscarriage. It was not tested for possible side effects, nor did anyone know what they were. Finally, a student at the University of Chicago Medical Center showed that not only was it ineffective in preventing miscarriage, but it might have side effects. This finding failed to halt its use. In 1972, its long-term effects began to appear: cancer of the breast, with vaginal cancer in daughters of those patients treated with DAY, as well as other genital malformations and abnormalities. It was also linked to liver damage. Lee Edison, in The Cancer Ripoff, notes that 74 private companies near the National Institute of Health in Bethesda were charging the government 144% overhead plus 9% profit to perform virus research. Nixon had placed his protege, Dr. Frank Rauska, in charge of NCI. He was a virologist who began to promote chemotherapy as the answer to cancer. Dr. Rauska claimed that the NCI chemotherapy program has provided effective treatment for cancer patients all over this country and the world. This claim was promptly challenged by Dean Burke, head of the psychochemical section of the NCI, pointing out that virtually all of the chemotherapeutic agents now approved by the FDA for use or testing in human cancer patients are highly toxic to markedly immunosuppressive and highly carcinogenic in rats and mice, themselves producing cancers in a wide variety of body organs. Despite this criticism, Rauska was then named head of the President's National Cancer Advisory Board. The side effects of chemotherapy have been graphically described by many of its victims: the terrible nausea, loss of hair, sudden weight loss, and many other adverse factors. A book by M. Morrow, Choices: Realistic Alternatives in Cancer Treatment, Avon, 1980, reports favorably on all of the establishment's cut-slash-and-burn techniques. Morrow mentions diet only in its relation to nausea from chemotherapy. He soberly advises that you let someone else do the cooking so that the smell of food won't nauseate you. Morrow gave no advice on how to serve food without smell. Since Memorial Sloan Kettering's first benefactor, James Ewing, dosed himself to death with radium in 1913, it has remained the treatment of choice at this cancer center. The New York Times noted July 4, 1979 that 70% of all cancer patients at Memorial receive radiation treatments, at a charge of $500,000 a year. It now performs 11,000 surgical procedures and 65,000 radium treatments a year. In 1980, Memorial bought all new equipment for its radium treatment, an expenditure of $4.5 million. However, radium treatment continues to be a horrifying treatment in its effects. In 1937, Dr. Percy Fernhill, a prominent surgeon at London Hospital, diagnosed his own tumor as cancer. On February 26, 1938, he published in the British Medical Journal an impassioned plea as a result of his experience. Tragedies from radium treatment are of frequent occurrence, and the publicity given to radium treatment of cancer is a disgrace to the Minister of Health and the vested interests which charge fantastic prices for this body-destroying substance. I do not wish my worst enemy the prolonged hell I have been through with radium neuritis and milge over 6 months. This account of my own case is a plea for a very careful consideration of all the factors before deciding which is the most suitable form of treatment. He died shortly thereafter, yet his plea had no effect on the continued use of radium treatments for cancer. The late Senator Hubert Humphrey, who died of cancer, is often cited as an advertisement for radium treatment. Jane Brodie in her New York Times book, You Can Fight Cancer and Win, co-authored with American Cancer Society Vice President Holleb in 1977, cites Hubert Humphrey as a famous beneficiary of modern radiotherapy. She glosses over the fact that this famous beneficiary was totally disillusioned with radium therapy before his death. In 1973 he was found to have cancer of the bladder, he was treated by X-ray, and in 1976, his physician Dr. Dabney Jarman triumphantly reported that, as far as we are concerned, the senator is cured. New York Times, October 6, 1976. Humphrey continued to wither away, undergoing more chemotherapy, until he flatly refused to go back to Memorial Cancer Center for more treatment. Quoted in the Daily News, January 14, 1978, he called chemotherapy bottled death. The Washington Post in February 1988 ran a story, Cancer Treatment Toxic, We Are Spared Very Little as We See Healthy-Looking People Turned Before Our Eyes into Shaking, Shivering, Nauseated Bundles of Misery. The successes, although few, have been dramatic. One factor which has been consistently ignored in the development of cancer is the role of unusual stress. We all face daily stresses in our lives, with which we cope as best we can. However, unusual and prolonged stress places a greater strain on our system than we may be able to cope with. This is particularly true today, when sinister hidden forces poison all our communications with their shadowy propaganda, while assuring us that they stand only for compassion and caring. A writer named Morley Roberts advanced a startling theory of cancer in 1926. An English scientist, Roberts belonged to no known school of thought, and because of his independence, his works have been largely ignored. His theory of organic materialism advances the following points: malignancy and devolution. Malignancy is the diversion of energy from high differentiation into the proliferation of low-grade epithelia which can endure irritation but only differentiate with difficulty. Epithelioma, a common form of cancer, is the multiplication of cells of the simplest type in the body, which, like those of the outer skin, the epidermis, are comparably short-lived and unable to differentiate. An organism afflicted with cancer is unable to differentiate to meet the conditions of its existence, because its energy has been diverted into multiplying low-grade cells. Cancer is the proliferation of low-grade cell colonies in the organism. They migrate through the body seeking a place for themselves, although they have no function. Wherever they gather, they rob the higher-grade cells of nourishment, where they are gathered into cell colonies as the organs of the body. These organs are choked off and starve, eventually causing the death of the organism. The modern state is a malignant organism dedicated to the proliferation of lower grade units at the expense of higher, more differentiated types. The more productive organisms are heavily taxed to support large numbers of non-productive and poorly differentiated growths. The steadily increasing strain on the productive members of the state causes their premature death, just as the proliferation of the lower grade cells in the cancerous organism kills the higher differentiated cells. Roberts posits the question, may we go further and even say that the common tendency to malignancy is the result of sociology refinements which ask for a higher role for epithelia? Morley Roberts posited a theory of the development of the organism, in which other cells began to gather around the excretory cell colonies of primitive organisms, and subsequently these cell colonies began to give off secretions which were poisonous to the organism. In self-defense, the organism threw up fortifications, or other cell colonies, around the vicious presence, which, in time, became part of the organism, and whose secretions became useful to it. Roberts calls this a theory of the development of the organs of the body. The role of nutrition in cancer has yet to be seriously researched by the billion-dollar boondoggles of the National Cancer Institute and the Rockefeller. Yet in 1887, an Albany, New York physician, Ephraim Cutter, M.D., wrote a book called Diet and Cancer, in which he stated, "Cancer is a disease of nutrition." Hippocrates coined the word diatia, meaning a way of life, which is what a diet is. In the classical world, meat meant the daily fare, and referred to oats, barley, rye, wheat, fruit and nuts. The confusion as to the meaning of the word meat occurs in translations of the Bible. In Genesis, it is stated, "Behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree, in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat." Hippocrates' advice to physicians was that they should first find out what food is given to a patient, and who gives it. The ongoing controversy over letrile revolves around the fact that it is a substance called a nitrilicide. In 1952, Dr. Ernest A. Krebs, Jr., a biochemist, discovered that cancer is caused by a deficiency of nitrilicides, which occur naturally in over 1,200 foods and plants. Animals usually instinctively seek out grasses and other plants which contain nitrilicides, yet when humans do the same thing they are attacked by federal agents. Some researchers believe that the adverse effects of carcinogens, radiation and sunburn on humans is caused by the fact that they are suffering from poor nutrition. These nutrition experts argue that coal tar does not cause cancer, and that the sun does not cause skin cancer. Rather, these conditions arise from the sun's effect upon the skin of a person who is consuming too many sugars, fats and dairy products. The sun's rays create an acidic condition which causes these substances to rise to the surface of the skin, causing an irritation which can then become catalyst. It is noted that people in tropical countries, who are exposed to strong sunlight, rarely get skin cancer because they eat little meat and fats. It was also discovered after the atomic bombing of Japanese civilians that those who were still eating their traditional diet of brown rice, sea salt and miso vegetables, were little damaged by the same amount of atomic radiation which killed those who were eating a more modern diet of fats and meat. Some experts note that they can detect cancer by the peculiar smell of a person in its early stages, the smell of decomposition. Others note that cancer can be detected by a greenish cast to the skin. The epidemic of prostate cancer among American men seems to be the result of a diet of rich foods, with frequent ingestion of eggs, meat and dairy products, and baked goods made with refined flour. A suggested remedy is a diet of fruit and rice, the same diet which is recommended to lower blood pressure and which has been featured at Duke University for many years. Beef is said to be particularly dangerous for prostate and colon cancer. Nutritionists believe that cancer represents a reverse evolutionary process, in which cells decompose or change back to a more primordial vegetable type of life. This corresponds in some ways with the theories of Morley Roberts. It is notable that only 4% of the nation's medical schools offer a course in nutrition. This reflects the Rockefeller medical monopoly's obsession with drugs and its commitment to the allopathic school of medicine, as opposed to homeopathic or holistic medicine. Nobel Prize winner James Watson declared at a cancer symposium admit that the American public has been sold a nasty bill of goods about cancer. A soporific orgy, as reported in the New York Times March 9, 1975. In January of 1975, Dr. Charles C. Edwards, a researcher, wrote to the secretary of Hugh that the war on cancer was politically motivated and was based on spending money. The prominent French oncologist, Dr. Lucien Israel, said, "Radium is an unproven method in many cases. Indeed, there have been no conclusive trials on radiation therapy." Israel terms it a palliative for relief of pain, etc., temporary in nature. He also points out that the medical community has been thrown into confusion by recent studies which have shown that metastases may be more frequent in cases that have received radiation. In short, the radiation increases the spread of cancer. It has long been known that cutting into a tumor causes it to spread throughout the body. The exploratory operation to see if you have cancer usually guarantees that it will be fatal. Nevertheless, the American Cancer Society continues to back all of the losing methods of treating cancer. For 20 years, it has patently repeated its famous cancer's 7 warning signals, which ignore chemicals in the environment and discounts FDAR warnings about coal tar and hair dyes. In 1976, the ACS released a press communication, "Urgent Message, Mammography, Benefits and Risks." Dr. John Bayler of the Harvard School of Public Health, and editor of the prestigious NCI Cancer Journal, was horrified. He wrote a letter to the acting director of the NCI, Dr. Guy Newell, "I have just become aware of a problem that has the seeds of a major disaster. The urgent message itself is plain hogwash, the statement is seriously faulty, and hence represents a grave danger to that bulk of women who should avoid mammography." Nevertheless, the ACS flyer went to every hospital in New York, and to 15,000 physicians. Despite the known risks of exposing women to repeated X-rays, the ACS still emphasizes annual mammographies as one of its most vaunted techniques for controlling cancer. Jane Brody's book, You Can Fight Cancer and Win, recommends this and many other ACS goals. The American Cancer Society also stands firmly behind radical mastectomy, the total removal of the breast in cases of women's breast cancer. This technique is frowned upon as unusually brutal and ineffective. It has long been abandoned in most European countries, including England, France and the Scandinavian countries and neighboring Canada. In 1975, when Rose Kuttner published her definitive work, Breast Cancer, which was critical of radical mastectomy, the ACS refused to list or recommend it. It was Elmer Bobst's goal to make the National Cancer Institute autonomous, much as the Federal Reserve System is autonomous. He was able to achieve this goal because of his long-standing personal connection with President Richard Nixon. As the mastermind of the American Cancer Society, he really intended it to become autonomous from Washington influence, while making it completely subservient to the American Cancer Society from New York. Rep. David Abay, Democrat, Wisconsin, noted that the American Cancer Society wants to keep the National Cancer Institute strong in bankroll and weak in staff so that it can direct its spending without too much interference. A very astute observation. One of its directors is Mary Lasker, who, 36 years after albeit Lasker's death, is still described by Washington observers as the most powerful woman in American medicine. The National Institute of Health bought the Visitation Convent in Bethesda from the Catholic Church for $4.4 million. It now houses the Mary Lasker Center. Through her access to funding, the ACS maintains full-time lobbyists in Washington, headed by Colonel Luke Quinn, and aided by Mike Gorman. The Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, with Washington lobbyist Lloyd Cutler, also works with Mary Lasker. Whatever else may be said of the American Cancer Society, there can be no doubt that it remains well insulated against reality. A leading Washington reporter, Daniel S. Greenberg, wrote in the Columbia Journalism Review in 1975 that cancer rates for most types of cancer had been static since the 1950s. Some rates actually declined, probably because the use of toxic chemotherapy increased the death rate. One researcher told Greenberg there had been little improvement since 1945. Dr. Frank Rauscher challenged Greenberg at the 1975 Axe Science Writers Seminar, claiming that these figures were out of date. However, when the new figures were released, they upheld Greenberg's findings. This rings hollowly against the annual promises of breakthroughs when the 2.5 million volunteers swarm across America shaking their tin cans and begging for the rich. They have been making these same promises and raising the same amounts of money, or more, for almost 50 years. Lawrence Rockefeller noted in Reader's Digest, February 1957, an exultant comment, "There is, for the first time, a scent of ultimate victory in the air," as he described, progress against cancer. Sloan Kettering, Director C.P. Dusty Rhodes, was quoted in the Denver Post, October 3, 1953, "I am convinced that in the next decade, or maybe more, we will have a chemical as effective against cancer as sulfanilamides and penicillin are against a bacterial infection. Well, maybe more." In 1956, Dr. Wendell F. Stanley, a Nobel Prize winner, reported in an address to the annual AMA convention, "Viruses are the prime cause of most types of cancer. Nothing more has been heard on this subject in 30 years. One physician, Dr. Cecil Pittard, was informed that he had terminal cancer and that he had only a few weeks to live. The Knoxville, Tennessee physician was diagnosed at the Mayo Clinic as having lymphoma. Lymphatic cancer results because the body is no longer able to detoxify or cleanse itself. Tonsillectomies often initiate a deterioration of the lymphatic system, resulting in lymph gland inflammation, and eventually, lymphatic cancer. With nothing to lose, Dr. Pittard experimented on himself with the anti-flu bacterial antigen, staphylococcus, and sodium butyrate, a fatty acid food found in milk and butter. He soon found that he had been completely cured. Nevertheless, the cancer establishment ignored his report, and became even more vociferous in its campaign against unproven remedies. In most cases like Dr. Pittard's, the cancer profiteers sneer that it probably was misdiagnosed and he never had cancer, or that he had a spontaneous remission, which is their most oft repeated response. It would seem that they would show some interest in how to obtain a spontaneous remission, because they have now been talking about it for half a century, yet we have heard nothing from the $70 million a year research program at Sloan Kettering about spontaneous remission. After Dr. Ralph Moss had been fired from Sloan Kettering for revealing the positive results of Lettrile experiments, he made public the fact that the Institute was sitting on many other results of successful treatment of cancer, including more than 1,000 positive cases of response to the Coley treatment since 1906. Moss reported that Dr. James Ewing, Coley's nemesis and arch rival, turned Memorial Hospital into a medical branch of the Radium Trust. Dr. William E. Koch, professor of physiology at Detroit Medical College and the University of Michigan, presaged for a radical pathology treatment with the development of glyoxylide, which stimulated the body to oxidate toxins. Although his treatment was never scientifically refuted, Koch, who began oxidation studies in 1915 and used this treatment since 1918, was persecuted for 16 years by the medical monopoly. He was finally driven out of the country, and died in Brazil in 1967. The FDA had started to harass him in 1920. The Wayne County Medical Society formed a cancer committee of doctors in 1923 who condemned Koch's treatment. His stimulation of cell oxidation treatment is by carefully planned diet which cleansed the system, yet this proven treatment is still denounced today by the cancer profiteers as quackery. Koch tried to continue his work in Mexico and Brazil, but the FDA refused to abandon their pursuit. He was prosecuted in 1942 and 1946. The FDA finally obtained a permanent injunction against the Koch treatment in 1950. Several physicians who had successfully treated cancer with the Koch treatment were expelled from the medical society. It was still allowable to kill a patient, but it was unforgivable to cure him. Another independent physician, Dr. Max Gerson, discovered that a vegetarian diet, with raw fruits and vegetables, and no salt, cured migraine and lupus. He continued his studies until he found that detoxification of the body could cure cancer. In 1958, he published his findings in his book, A Cancer Therapy, emphasizing a low-fat diet, no salt and a minimum of protein. In 1964, he was invited to testify before a Senate subcommittee, which produced a 227-page report, document number 89,471. The copies of this report were never distributed by the Senate, it received no coverage in medical journals, and Dr. Gerson never received 1 cent from any charitable organization such as the American Cancer Society to either prove or disprove his findings, even though these groups claimed they were researching a cure for cancer. Another famous case was that of Harry Hoxsey, who used a herbal treatment, based upon Indian remedies, for cancer for 35 years. In a well-publicized court battle, Hoxsey won a libel suit against Morris Fishbin. The good doctor was forced to admit under cross-examination that he, the most famous doctor in the United States, had never practiced medicine one day in his life. Dr. Robert E. Lincoln discovered the bacteriophage method of conquering cancer, in which viruses parasitically attach and destroy specific bacteria. He received national attention when he cured the son of Senator Charles Toby with this method. Toby was astounded to learn that Dr. Lincoln has been expelled from the Massachusetts Medical Society because he was curing people of cancer. He conducted a congressional investigation, in which his special counsel from the Department of Justice, Benedict Fitzgerald, wrote, April 28, 1953, the alleged machinations of Dr. J. Moore, for the past 10 years the treasurer of American Medical Association, could involve the AMA and others in a conspiracy of alarming proportions. Behind and over all this is the weirdest conglomeration of corrupt motives, intrigues, selfishness, jealousy, obstruction and conspiracy I have ever seen. My investigation to date should convince this committee that a conspiracy does exist to stop the free flow and use of drugs in interstate commerce which allegedly have solid therapeutic value. Public and private funds have been thrown around like confetti at a country fair to close up and destroy clinics, hospitals and science research laboratories which do not conform to the viewpoint of medical associations. How long will the American people take this? 35 years, they are still taking it. The outcome of the Toby hearings is instructive. Senator Toby died suddenly of a heart attack, as happens in Washington when a politician treads on dangerous ground. He was succeeded on the committee by Senator John Bricker of Ohio. Bricker, for many years, was considered to be a dedicated conservative by millions of Americans. In reality, he was the lawyer for a number of large drug manufacturers and bankers, the ultimate establishment figure. He promptly fired special counsel Benedict Fitzgerald, the hearings were then closed down. Dr. Robert Lincoln was bold enough to sue the Massachusetts Medical Society for libel. He also died before the case could come to trial. Dr. Andrew C. Ivey, vice president of the University of Illinois, began to use a preparation which he called Crebiosin. He succeeded in curing cancer with it. The AMA promptly published a report on Crebiosin which ruled that it was of no benefit. A 289-day trial resulted, in which Dr. Ivey was cleared of all counts against him. Dr. Peter DeMarco, a graduate of Hahnemann Medical School, successfully treated over 800 patients with procaine polyvinyl pyrrolidone. His license to practice medicine in New Jersey was revoked. A favorite recommendation of the American Cancer Society is the Pap test for cancer, despite its many drawbacks. Insight magazine, January 11, 1988, criticized many diagnostic laboratories for doing sloppy work, quoting the Wall Street Journal of November 1987 that Pap smears have a false negative rate of from 20 to 40%, a false negative means death by cancer. Stung by this exposure of a method which the Axe had frenetically promoted for many years, Dr. Harmon J. Eyre, president of the American Cancer Society, called a joint press conference of the ACS, the AMA, and the NCI, to renew their joint recommendation that all women from 20 to 60 have an annual pap smear. At this press conference reported by AP, January 20, 1988, Eyre was quoted, "A main reason for calling the press conference was an attempt to counter confusion about the value of the pap test in light of recent publicity about the percentage of false negative results from some labs." Although he went on record with unqualified endorsements of the pap tests, Eyre offered no answer to the problem of false negative reports or the terrible threat which it posed to many women. Some women's groups are becoming alerted to the fact that the medical monopoly is needlessly condemning many women to death. The Washington Post noted, February 16, 1988, a report of a women's health trial, in which 300 women demanded low-fat tests in which fat in the diet would be reduced from 40% to 20%, the purpose being to diminish breast cancer. They asked for funding from the NCI, but the Board of Scientific Counselors of NCI refused to advance any funding for the project. The women's spokesman pointed out that NCI is committed to breast cancer control rather than prevention. What would the most powerful woman in American medicine have said about this? Mary Lasker has been content to play the part of the gracious Lady Bountiful with the money her husband earned as the nation's most famous huckster. At the American Cancer Society's Science Writers Seminars, which are held each year in some exotic hotel during the harsh winter months, Science noted May 18, 1973, that these spring seminars, held annually since 1949, always are held in warm climates, free junkets for science editors at big circulation newspapers and magazines. Science pointed out that these seminars, which cost ACS about $25,000, generate about 300 favorable news stories and result in ACS raising about $85 million in extra donations. This is probably one of the best investments around. In 1957, novelist Hans Uyen, wearing an exquisite fur coat, delivered an enthusiastic report to the Science writers about how much good the chemical manufacturers have done for the health of our citizens. In all fairness to Han, Love Canal had not been discovered in 1957. The seminar met recently, 1973, at the fabulous Rio Rico in near Tucson, Arizona. Not only are all expenses paid for the complaisant writers, but an extra treat, a happy hour at the bar at the end of each work day, makes certain that the journalists float into dinner in a very jovial mood. The happy hour is paid for by the gracious Mary Lasker. Saturday Review noted April 10, 1965, the ACS had an unusually effective public relations department. The secret of public relations is to obtain free space in major publications, instead of buying advertising. The Lasker connection also ensures that major New York agencies such as McCann Erickson prepare advertising campaigns for ACS at no charge. It is ironic that Albert Lasker, the co-creator of the American Cancer Society as we know it, and its subsidiary creature, the National Cancer Institute, should have built much of his fortune on his promotion of cigarette smoking. After his death from cancer, the American Cancer Society reluctantly came to the conclusion that smoking is bad for your health. The mounting death toll from lung cancer forced the cigarette companies to consider alternatives. One of these was filters. On January 1, 1954, Kent Cigarettes released an ad to 80 newspapers that AMA tests had proved the Kent filters were the most efficient in removing cigarette tar. Because this proof was on a par with most other AMA claims, the AMA was compelled to protest to Lori Lard, the manufacturer. Time magazine commented, April 12, 1954. The usually soporific AMA barred advertisements for Kent cigarettes. When the Surgeon General released his 1964 report on the harmful effects of cigarette smoking, it panicked the industry, even though it had long been heralded by previous studies. In June 1954, Dr. Daniel Horn and Edward K. Eller Hammond presented a report to the AMA convention, linking smoking and lung cancer. Horn and Hammond headed the statistical department at the Axe. American Tobacco, one of Lasker's principal holdings, dropped 5 points in one day after this presentation. Hammond was a well-known epidemiologist who had served as a consultant to the U.S. Navy, USAF and the Brookhaven Lab. He was a vice president of Axe and director of its research. Although he had conducted extensive research on the effects of smoking, he steadfastly refused to share this material with other organizations. In 1971, he received an invitation to join a panel of scientists to discuss smoking. He refused, stating that it had been the policy of Axe since 1952 not to share data with other researchers. Current Biography reported in 1957 that Hammond smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day. His wife smoked 3 packs a day. They both died of lung cancer. Despite the Axe revelations, the tobacco interests, which were closely linked to the Rockefeller medical monopoly, fought a determined rearguard action against the lung cancer campaign. One of Washington's best-connected lobbyists, Patricia Firestone Chatham, widow of Representative R. T. Chatham, the chairman of Chatham Mills textile firm, stalled the placement of the warning on cigarette packages, "Smoking may be dangerous to your health," for 5 years, from 1964 to 1969. She lives in a $2 million mansion in Georgetown, the former James Forrestal home. The furor over lung cancer and smoking ignores a pertinent fact, that primitive tribes have been smoking tobacco for thousands of years, with no disagreeable after effects. In Virginia, origin of this writer, Indians were smoking tobacco when Captain John Smith landed at Jamestown. Dr. Richard Parsi, a researcher at London's Chester Beatty Research Institute, conducted 20 years of research on the tobacco problem. He found no significant link between the traditionally air-dried tobacco and lung cancer. However, the American and English tobacco industries, which are dominated by the Rothschilds, use sugar in their tobacco, for a sweetened, sugar-dried effect. England uses 17% sugar, the United States 10%. England has the highest lung cancer rate in the world. Dr. Parsi concluded that the addition of sugar to tobacco creates a carcinogenic substance in the nicotine tar. In air-dried tobacco, this carcinogen is not activated. He found no resulting lung cancer in the Soviet Union, China and Taiwan, all of which produce air-dried tobacco. Esquire magazine featured a lengthy article on the work of the Janka Clinic in Bonn, Germany, finding that this clinic has treated 76,000 cancer cases since 1936, with full or partial remission in 70% of their patients. The Esquire reporter was astounded to learn that the National Cancer Institute refuses to use Janka Clinic isophosphamide, A. Mulsin, Wobi enzymes and other successful Janka techniques because they refuse to use sufficient dosage. The American Cancer Society is even more rigid. It prides itself on keeping the Janka techniques out of the United States. The Esquire reporter went on to complain that the American Cancer Society has become a major part of the problem. It eschews sponsorship of chemical and research innovation and instead goes in for propaganda. Cigarettes are harmful, the 7 danger signals, celebrity radio and TV spots, and it virtually condemns and suppresses unorthodox methods which, incidentally, it does not even trouble itself to investigate thoroughly. The reporter did not know that the American Cancer Society has a vested interest in the established forms of cancer treatment. For instance, it holds a 50% ownership of the patent rights of 5-FU, 5-fluorouracil, one of the toxic drugs now in vogue as an acceptable medication for cancer. 5-FU and a later development 5-4-FU are produced by Hoffman La Roche Laboratories. The Night Rider News Service reported in 1978 that the Axe refused to take a position on suspected pesticides which caused cancer. The Axe board and its allied organization, Sloan Kettering, have many members who are heads of the largest chemical firms in the United States. The war against pollution will win no adherents there. Axe was asked to take a position on other dangerous substances, such as red dye hash 2, the fire retardant trees, used in children's clothing. It has since been banned, and forms of synthetic estrogen. Yet Axe again refused to state its position on these substances. To counter its baneful influence, the Committee for Freedom of Choice in Medicine planned to file an action in 1984 before the Permanent Committee on Human Rights at the United Nations, charging that the American medical establishment was in violation of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights and the International Human Rights Agreement of 1966. Its prepared statement noted that Americans have been needlessly slaughtered and criminalized because a host of useful products, medicine and metabolic nutritional approaches in medicine have been crushed by vested interests. The committee termed the present situation a medigut. The failure to reduce the death rate from cancer is a grim indictment of the insurmountable obstacles which the Axe has placed in the path of a viable approach to this problem. John Baylor of the Harvard School of Public Health, addressing the American Association for the Advancement of Science Indiana 19867, pointed out that the government's 15-year-old national cancer program has not lowered the death rate for major forms of cancer and should therefore be considered a failure. It has not produced the results it was supposed to produce. Baylor was well qualified to make this observation. He had been editor of the journal FinSci for 25 years. He was supported by a fellow member of the faculty of the School of Public Health, Dr. John Cairns, who reported that, in the past 20 years, cancer has increased. There have been no significant gains against cancer since the 1950s. Dr. Hardin James addressed the Axe panel in 1969. A professor of medical physics at the University of California at Berkeley, he stated that his studies had proven conclusively that untreated cancer victims actually live up to 4 times longer than treated individuals. For a typical type of cancer, people who refused treatment live an average of 12 and a half years. Those who accepted surgery and other kinds of treatment lived an average of only 3 years. I attribute this to the traumatic effect of surgery on the body's natural defense mechanism. The body has a natural type of defense against every type of cancer. In February 1988, the National Cancer Institute released its definitive report, summarizing the war against cancer. It reported that over the past 35 years, both the overall incidence and death rates from cancer have increased, despite advances in detection and treatment. Washington Post, February 9, 1988. The problem may be that, just as in other wars we have engaged in the 20th century, too many of those on our side are actually working for the enemy.